Hey folks, so the usual rules apply. I'll let you know when the quizzes are done. You can come pick them up. Today I want to continue our discussion of real options. First, I want to make sure everybody's clear about why patents are an option or what has to be true for patents to be an option. You got to have legal protection against competition, but remember the competition you're protected against is only on the products that emerged from that patent. So if you got a drug to treat diabetes and a particular drug, you get protection on that drug. You don't get protection against other companies working on their own drugs. And that undercuts the value. The exclusivity again starts to fail. So let's pass patents through the test. Is there an option? Clearly. The contingency is you will develop the patent if and only if the present value of the cash flows from developing the patent exceed the cost of the patent. Is there exclusivity? As we said, no. Yes. With the condition that if other companies are working on competing products, the exclusivity doesn't go away, but it starts to fail. That's why with Avonex, you saw that quicker development. And finally, can I use an option pricing model? I'm really stretching option pricing models, right? The underlying asset is not traded. The patent is not traded. Replication is impossible. Arbitrage is impossible. It's on. Can you guys on Zoom hear me on the mic? That mic is always live. So mic is on. You still can't hear me, but with the last session too, I had trouble with the mic. Maybe the mic is going. So which case, too late to fix it for today's class. Nothing I can do about it. But if you look at, can I apply an option pricing model? You're stretching the limits of option pricing models. Replication impossible, arbitrage impossible. You put in an option pricing model, you get a number, not sure what you can do with that number. So today I want to move on to a second example of an option to delay. It's with natural resource companies. If you think about natural resource companies, you can break them into two parts again. Existing reserves that they've already developed, which are not options because you're always coming out of those reserves, and undeveloped reserves that they would like to develop. They have the right to develop. So again, let's set up the structure. Let's say the cost of developing these reserves is X, and the expected value of oil under the reserves is V. If V is greater than X, you will develop the reserves and keep the difference. If that's not the case, you will sit on those reserves. Classic example of this is Petrobras. Developed millions of barrels of oil in reserve when oil prices were high. Then when oil prices dropped, they had the reserves, they were not viable, but they were still valuable as options just in case oil prices go back up. So if I were to draw a payoff diagram for developing undeveloped reserves, the cost of developing the reserve becomes the equivalent of the strike price. The value of the oil under the ground, estimated oil under the ground, becomes the equivalent of the stock price. It's the life of this option. Depends on how long you get the reserves for, right? In much of the world, the way you get reserves for is you bid for them at government auctions. So Arctic oil reserves opened up. The auction gives you the right to develop the reserves for a finite period, after which the reserves revert back to the government. It's not in perpetuity. A century ago, that wasn't true. You got the reserves, you basically own them. Okay? So you have 20 years, that becomes the life of the option. And here again, we need to introduce a cost of delay, right? Because if you have reserves that become viable, part of you says, let's wait. Oil prices could go to $150 a barrel. But the other part says, if we don't develop the reserves now, we'll give up the cash flows we can get from developing the reserves. That becomes a cost of delay. But I'm explicitly emphasizing the cost of delay. It's a central theme in real options. Most real options, you have to have an estimate of a cost of delay. It's the equivalent of the dividend yield, which forces the option to get exercised. So let's try this. If I had to value an undeveloped reserve, let's go input by input again. I need a value of the reserves in the ground. First, how do oil companies know how many barrels of oil there are in the ground? Presumably, this is why they hire all those geologists to go tap the ground, say 100 million barrels. And you know what? Their track record on detecting oil is much better than macroeconomists forecasting interest rates. I'm not going to pick on them. They're 80 million barrels, 100 million barrels. You multiply by the oil price today, which you know you can use forward, but it's got to be today's prices. That becomes BS. Much easier than the value of an option, right? We had to do present value of the cash flows. Here there's oil, there's an oil price. You get the value of the reserve in the ground. What's the cost of developing the reserve? Well, it depends on where in the world you are. If this is Saudi Arabia, the reserves might cost almost nothing to develop. The oil's so close to the ground. But if it's Canada, it might require a huge amount of investment. And oil companies have a pretty good sense of what that is. That becomes the strike price. The time to expiration year is however long you have the rights to this reserve. The longer those rights last, the more valuable the reserves become to you. And in this case, actually, the variance becomes much simpler to compute than in the case of a patent. Remember, there you had to run a simulation on cash flow, see what that standard deviation was. What's the big unknown here? What will happen to oil prices? But oil prices are traded asset, a traded commodity. You can get the standard deviation in oil prices over time. That becomes the variance in values, basically the variance in the oil price. It's an observable. Already you can see why real options have their deepest roots in natural resource companies. Natural resource companies actually use real options in a tangible way because the numbers are easier to get. Each year that you produce from the reserve, the cash flows you get becomes the equivalent of the dividend yield. That's a cost of delay because now I'm saying it's a viable reserve. You don't produce it. That cash flow is not coming. There's one final aspect of undeveloped natural resource reserves that has to be brought into play. Let's say you have an oil company. You have undeveloped reserves. Oil prices go up from $50 to $80. The reserves are not now viable. You decide to develop them. The oil come out of the ground the next day. Between the decision to develop and actual oil coming out of the ground, it can take a year, 2 years, depending on where the reserves are and how you get them out of the ground. There's a delay between when you make the choice to develop. And that's, you know, intuitively, you know, that's going to reduce the value of the option because you get out there, you're all excited, oil price are $80, you decide to put the order out to develop the reserves. You know what can happen in the 2 years you wait before the oil comes out of the ground? It could go back down to $60. Essentially, there's a present value effect that's got to be factored in that's going to lower the value of that oil reserve. So let me try this on a real company. It's a really old case, and the only reason I have to go back to this case is the data that I needed to value the undeveloped reserves was fully provided. The company called Gulf Oil that was targeted for a hostile acquisition in 1984. So the price at which it was being bid at was $70. And one of the reasons it was targeted is because of its undeveloped reserves. So here's what Gulf Oil had as undeveloped reserves. They had 3.038 billion barrels of oil in undeveloped reserves all over the world. The estimate then was that the cost of developing these reserves would be about $10. Per barrel. So it'll cost them $30.38 billion if they decide to develop all the reserves right away. So think of that as the strike price. It's what they would have to invest up front to develop these reserves. So I have the K for the model. The value, the price of oil at that time was $22.38 per barrel. And the variable cost of extracting the oil was seven. So every barrel of oil they get out of the ground, they make $15.38. So you can think of what that present value would be over time of developing the reserves. Incidentally, they had the rights to these reserves on average for 12 years. The reason I throw the on average is these reserves were in different parts of the world. Some parts had 6 years, some part 15. The average was about 12. And finally, the oil price variance was about 0.03. And you can make it into a standard deviation, but basically the variance in oil price was 0.03. That's what's going to drive the optionality. Oil prices are volatile. You're trying to make a bet on, should I develop reserves right now? T-bond rate then was 9%. This is actually not a made-up number. The T-bond rate in 1984 was 9%. So when you hear people bitching and moaning about 3.5% rates and how horrific it is and how nobody can live at these rates, hey, people have lived with far higher rates in the past. So let's take this apart. So let's suppose you want to value these undeveloped reserves. First thing I did was I took the 3,038 million barrels and I took a shortcut. Normally you'd have to estimate how much oil you'd produce each year, get the expected cash flows each year, and take the present value using a cost of capital for an oil company, right? So basically that's how you do discounted cash flow valuation. Here I took the 3,038 million barrels, multiplied by 1538, that's a variable, the contribution, the profit they make per barrel. And I've said, look, I have to wait 2 years before I get to see the oil, even if I decide. So that's basically bringing back the cash flows for the first 2 years. I get a present value of oil under the ground of 42.38 billion. I want you to remember that number. So if I develop the reserves today with a 2 year lag, the value of the oil is 42.38 billion. The cost I'll have to invest upfront to do this is 30.38. So I take 42.38 minus 30.38. I get a discounted cash flow valuation of these reserves. That discounted cash flow valuation is $12 billion. And that's where we'd stop with DCF, right? Let's see what optionality does for us here. You have 12 years left in the reserves, oil price are volatile, the riskless rate of 9%, and the equivalent of the dividend yield becomes 5%, the cash you leave under the ground. You take the D1, D2, N of D1, N of D2. Did, remind me again what N of D2 tells me? It's a rough estimate of the likelihood that this option will be in the money, which means there's an 85.4% chance I will develop the reserves. No surprise, because these are viable reserves already. But here's the magic of option pricing. You plug those numbers in, the value that you get for these reserves that we just valued at 12 billion with the DCF model becomes $13.3 billion. Where's the extra? I mean, this is magical, right? I've taken a DCF value, added 1.3 billion. What is that extra 1.3 billion in value? Or where is it coming from? Can't be time. And I'll tell you why. If I take the variance of oil prices and make them zero, what will happen to the value of the option? It's going to go to 12 billion. In other words, all of the value will disappear the minute the variance goes from 3% to 0%. If I take the variance of oil price and push them to 10%, that extra premium will jump to 2.5 billion. So it can't just be time value, because it seems to be a function of the variance in the oil price. Yes, sir.
How do you practically use that information?
Well, in two ways. One is when you have non-viable reserves and somebody comes to you and says, look, I'd like to buy a non-viable reserve for you, which oil companies do all the time when oil prices, you know, drop to really low levels. You can estimate the value of the reserves. Right now, they're non-viable, but there'll be an option value because, and the more volatile oil prices become, the more careful you got to be about not giving away undeveloped reserves, even if they're non-viable. The premium is coming from the fact that as oil prices move, the reserves could go from being low value reserves to high value reserves.
And if you own the reserve in a situation, what's the
in this case, you actually will hold off on developing at least some of the reserves. So in a sense, the higher the variance in oil prices become, the more you will find oil companies holding back on developing the reserves right away, because there is a value to waiting. Of course, there is this existential question that oil companies face now. Is what, 10 years from now, you're not allowed to take any oil out of the ground. But if you did not have that, you can see why oil companies... And this is why when oil prices jump to $140 a barrel, you don't see everybody trying to develop everything. There's another implicit assumption we're making here that can also kind of crimp your development of the reserves. As you develop the reserves, you have no effect on oil prices. I take 3.038 billion, and demand and supply basically leaves the oil prices where it is. That might be okay if you're a small oil company, but Aramco said, look, we're going to take 300 billion barrels of oil out of the ground right now. Then it's almost like a you know, when you have an employee option, the exercise of the option affects the stock price. So very large oil companies have to be cautious about not jumping in just because reserves have become viable, because it's got to be some buffer. There's going to be a price effect. Okay. Yes?
How would you reflect the viability of reserves?
There are only two numbers, right? S and K. That's it. So where does the viability show up? If S is greater than K, the reserves are viable. If S is less than K, they're not viable. That's it. It's as simple as that. If the present value of the oil you will get from developing the reserves is less than the cost of developing the reserves, you're underwater. These are non-viable reserves. And there's a problem here because oil companies are required to report reserves, but only viable reserves. So if you look at many oil company 10Ks, there will be a footnote on these are reserves, but they're required to report only viable reserves, which means as oil prices drop, you'll actually see reserves reported drop off. It's not that they have less reserves, but they're not required. Some oil companies go well beyond what's required, and it will show you all reserves and the percentage which are viable. The reason I went back to 1984 in Gulf Oil, they showed all their reserves with the development cost, so I could see that I was not leaving any reserves in the ground. Because if all I do is apply this on viable reserves, I'm missing the other part of the reserves, which still have option value, right? Because oil prices could change enough to make them viable. But it does create some interesting implications. We know the value of an oil company is affected by the level of oil prices. We all know that's pretty straightforward, right? You know what this also tells you, right? Not only is the level of oil prices critical, but how volatile oil prices are can also affect the value of an oil company. The best case scenario for oil companies is high and volatile. The worst case scenario is low and boring. 1980s and 90s killed oil companies. Oil prices went to $25 a barrel and just stayed there. But you can also see low and volatile, you might benefit still as an oil company with the volatility, and companies with lots of reserves will benefit more than companies that get the bulk of their value from developing existing reserves. So natural resource reserves are interesting because they allow you to, you're getting closer to being able to apply option pricing models. Can you trade the underlying asset? What is the underlying asset? It's the oil under the ground. It's a tradable asset. Can you trade the option? Reserves get bought and sold all the time between oil companies. This is about as close as you can get to an option pricing model working all the way through. So finally, I'm going to bring those reserves in to try to value Gulf Oil as a company. Gulf Oil at the time that I looked at this had developed reserves and undeveloped reserves. The developed reserves had about 10 years of cash flows left at $915 million a year. I discounted those reserves the traditional way at a cost of capital that reflects the risk. So basically everything we have in DCF, in our architecture, we pull out, take the $915 million, treat it as an annuity for the next 10 years, present value is $5.065 million. I take that as my starting point. To that, I add the value of the undeveloped reserves, $13.3 billion. The total value of the firm is the sum of the two. Again, if I just did not want to bring out the option technology here, I could take the company, put in a higher growth rate, say they have lots of reserves and do that as an alternative, but don't do both. Don't do a DCF with a growth rate because they have reserves. And then on top of that, add the value of the reserves as an option because that would be double counting. Yes. Yeah, it's an option on an option. I'm not sure what that does for you, an option on lots of things. I'm going to argue later today that stock in a publicly traded company is an option. Option to liquidate, right? You own the equity. So you have options on options on options, and they start to compound over time. So it's a variance at each level kind of digging in. And, you know, and the further down the ladder you are in terms of where you are with the options, the more pain you will feel in terms of volatility, or actually gain you will see from volatility. So any questions on, so undeveloped reserves, there's clearly an option, there's clearly exclusivity. It comes from the fact that natural resources are limited, and it's the closest you're going to get to being able to meet the conditions for an option pricing model. So oil companies have been using options for 30 years now internally on decisions on how to value reserves, whether to shut down reserves and open reserves. Now, mining companies do it all the time. And you can see that it works for them because the mechanics work out. So any asset that has natural scarcity kind of meets this exclusivity condition. You know that a building in New York has significant optionality. First, the fact that real estate, it's an island, right? It's not Kansas City. You can't keep building out and further away. You go to Vegas, you can see there's really no constraint. So to begin with, as an island, you have limited land. But here's the reason the optionality in real estate in New York kicks in. You know that almost every square foot of New York has restrictions on what can be built on it. So if you bought, if you were able to buy an old building down in the East Village, which is three floors, and say, you know what, I'm just going to knock it down and build a 50-floor building, it's not that simple. The square footage is already specified. Of course, right now you're under the square footage. You don't want to develop it right now because you don't think you can make the rental income. You can see the optionality. You're paying for the building and the option to convert that building into a 9-story building. There are options in real estate that often affect the value of a property and how much you're willing to pay for a property. It's not that you plan to develop the property right now, but the right to develop the property becomes that added value that you're willing to pay. But it's going to be greater in Manhattan than in a part of the world where you can essentially, where real estate is not as constrained. You can basically build up. Let's talk about the option to expand. And this is where I think things get interesting, because here's how the option to expand goes by. I come to you with a project and I tell you up front, look, this is a terrible project, net present value, negative net present value project. And just as you get ready to shut it down, I say, but it could give you the rights to a second project, which could potentially be lucrative. And you say, what does that mean? Potentially lucrative. Right now it looks bad too. So essentially you're taking a bad project for the rights to an even worse project done. The first project is not an option. You're going to take it. But if you do, there is this option to expand, right? Right now it looks bad, but here's why it could still have value. Think about the payoff diagram. You could spend the additional money to expand. When would you do it? Only if you believe the present value of the cash flows from expanding are greater than the cost of expansion. So you take the first bad project saying, yeah, maybe the second project will pay off. I get, no, over the next 10 years. Could that in the second project never materialize? Yeah, in which case, what do you lose? Whatever the net negative net present. So see this cost of the option? That's a negative net present value of the first project. You essentially write it off saying, I wish I hadn't taken that first project. It sounds innocuous, but this is at the heart of the strategic argument, right? When people say this is a strategic investment, what are they saying? This investment is not going to make money, but it could give us all this neat stuff in the future. It's an options argument. They don't use that language, but they're using an options argument. So let's see when that argument makes sense and when it doesn't. And I'll use a very simplistic valuation to illustrate how this can add value to your DCF. Let's say you value a company. Okay. This is it's an antivirus software company. You do the expected free cash flow, cost of capital, you come up with $115 million. It's a small company, $115 million. You're done. The DCF value is done. And then the company says, look, in the process of selling our software, we're collecting data on our customers that we can use to create a second business, a database business. So this is a platform argument. We have a platform of customers who use our existing virus software. We're collecting data on that platform that will allow us to come up with a database business. And I ask you, well, how much will it cost you to build that business? You said it'll cost us about $500 million. What will you make? Well, about $40 million a year and after-tax cash flows for the next 10 years. Already, without even doing present value, you can see this is not looking like a great business, right? You invest $500 million up front. You make $40 million every year for the next 10 years. You don't even have to do any present value. You're already underwater. By the way, it is a risky business, so the cost of capital is 12%. Let's assume that there is substantial uncertainty about how the database business will evolve. So 50% standard deviation. That's what's going to potentially rescue you. You have the capacity to develop the second product in a new business and the standard deviation. The risk-free rate is 3%. So here's what I'm going to do. I know the discounted cash flow value, 115 million. I said it to the SAG. I said, look, there is this option to develop a second business. Let's see how much that business, that option is worth. So the S in the model is the present value of 40 million for 10 years at a 12% cost of capital. I come up with 226 million. The strike price, the cost of entering the market is 500 million. You take the difference between those two numbers as a pure NPV, it's minus 274 million. Here's the magic and danger of optionality. I now say, look, only I can do it because I'm collecting the data. I have, in this case, 5 years to develop it and a standard deviation of 50% in. The value of the call option I get with those absolutely horrendous inputs for S and K are $56 million. In businesses where there's an extreme amount of uncertainty, even bad technologies will sell for high prices because you're effectively buying options. They're not mispricing them. So in fact, right now, I'll wager AI products and services are selling for absolutely absurd prices because people see a big market in this. And the question you got to ask is, how much exclusivity do I get? That's really what this rests on. You have to convince me that the data you're collecting that will allow you to create this database business is unique to you. As opposed to what a lot of the user-based companies use this argument implicitly, right? They said, look, I know I'm Lime, I rent out bikes, I know the business is never going to work out, but I'm collecting data on my users and I might be able to come up with a new business that I can use the data on. The only problem is the kind of data Lime collects on users is primarily location data. It's not preference data, it's not, which 100 other companies have. You can very quickly see the options argument start to dissipate if you test them on exclusivity. So it is true that this argument can be used to justify, you know, adding a premium to a DCF, entering into a big market, even though you're not going to make money. But I think you need to ask the right question. In this case, the question you got to ask is, what is that exclusivity? Where does it come from? And you can frame it in terms of competitive advantages, right? Because if you have superior competitive advantages, barriers to entry, that's a version of exclusivity. You can say, look, I and only I can do this. And even though it's not viable today, the option to do it is worth a lot. And the less your competitive advantages are, the less value there is to the expansion option. So the next time you hear somebody using a strategic argument, push them on the exclusivity component. Because if you fight them on the strategic domain, you will always lose. Because big thinkers always look like, hey, you know, I have vision, you don't. This has nothing to do with vision. It's about the fact that I agree with you, AI is a big market, but why this product? What is the exclusivity that comes with it? Because without the exclusivity, the value, the option dissipates very quickly. So the option to expand, is there an option? Yeah, technically, yes. It's on the second project, not the first one. Is there exclusivity? That's where the questioning begins, because sometimes there is. If the case I gave you, it came from the fact that you collected data that was unique that you could use to develop a second business. But lots of times there isn't. If there isn't exclusivity, take the options argument off the table. Can I use an option pricing model? Again, I'm risking a lot of assumptions, right? Can I trade the underlying asset? Not really. There is no business. The database business doesn't exist. The business doesn't exist. The option on the business doesn't exist. Again, it's very much like patents. I'm using an option pricing model where neither replication nor arbitrage is that easy to do. The way this is going to play out in your valuation, and I'll tell you how it played out in one of my valuations. I remember when right after the Cambridge Analytica scandal, when Facebook stock price dropped, I'd always found Facebook to be overvalued for much of its public existence until that scandal hit. The stock price dropped, it dropped, but barely below the value that I had. I think the value was that I got was 132, the stock was at 129. and I chose to buy it, which goes against what investors are told, right? You need a margin of safety. The margin of safety should be larger for riskier firms and smaller for safer firms. And I remember getting pushback saying, you know, why would you buy Facebook? And I said, look, I value Facebook as an online advertising company. It has 3 billion users in its ecosystem. Right now, all it does is sell them advertising. Is it collecting exclusive data on its users? God, is it collecting data that you don't even want to know what they know about you? It's at the heart of the problem with Facebook, right? When you say privacy, it's basically saying they're collecting data about me that I don't want them to know. My response is going to be unprintable, but I will leave it there. But they are collecting data. Right now, they either haven't figured out how to use their data or they feel a little queasy about using that data. But there is an optionality here. There is no debate that there is optionality in Facebook. The question we can argue is how big is that value? But here, the way it affected my decision is, look, I think Facebook is close to fairly valued, but that's without the option. We can debate how much the option is worth, but it's icing on top of my valuation. So while I don't explicitly value this option to expand, it comes into play when I make investment decisions. I'm far more likely to buy, you know, Google when it's 5% undervalued than I am to buy Coca-Cola when it's 5% undervalued. What's the optionality you're going to get in Coca-Cola? What are they going to do? Come up with a beverage that makes you thinner? Don't ask me. That's a risky thing to even throw out there. There's not much upside left there, right? Doesn't make it a bad investment. It just, the way it shows up in a good year for Coca-Cola will be a 30%. So outcomes here, the best case. So if you did a simulation of Coca-Cola's value, your best case value is not going to be 15 times or 20 times your estimated value. It's probably 1.5 or 2 times your estimated value. It's a different kind of investment. There's a place for Coca-Cola in your portfolio, but there's also a place for companies with optionality. So as you look at platform companies, you look at a Zoom, you look at a Peloton, they've been beaten up over the last 2 years. There's a point where you have to decide, step in and say, you know what, they've been beaten up, but they've also collected information. The question you got to ask is that unique information? I'm not sure what Peloton collects about its subscribers, but I'm pretty sure it's got something to do with what kind of physical activity, you know, how much you do. Know, and whether you're regular about the activity or not, and if they chose to use it, they could. I mean, think of Weight Watchers, right? It's been around forever. Recently, they bought a drug that's been approved by the FDA. For the first time, they went from their traditional, we'll send you meals. So the traditional Weight Watcher model is, you subscribe to Weight Watcher, you get a social network of people who try to talk you into not overeating, but you also get... This is the first time they've gone past that. But you can see the potential, right? They know a great deal about the users who trust them. There are very few. And to the extent that they can trust them, this might give them a platform to take a drug like this and say, you know what, this is the 10% of our users where it's most useful. It's an optionality coming into play. And
you're in danger of double counting internal values of it. Capture a lot of the unknown upside.
Terminal value does. Your growth rate might. It depends on what went into your growth rate. The growth rate I used was an online advertising growth rate. Remember, you said the total addressable market, market share. So unless you've somehow set a total addressable market that includes two other potential businesses, in which case you're right, there's double counting. No. So you, since you control what you did in your DCF, you know what you've already counted. So
Bill Gurley's valuation of Uber. First one, and captured the optionality of
the- That was really about the change in the car service business, the optionality being the overall car service business. He wasn't really, I mean, to be quite honest, Uber's really never figured out how to make money in anything other than car service and food delivery, right? Trucking basically is just a morass. No, moving, I don't even think they Uber Moving even is around anymore. But that was one of the things. He did throw it out there, but he never put a number out there, right? Which is, and I didn't even try to bring in some of the new businesses they could do. Yeah. Right now, do you think Tesla bulls are making an options argument for Tesla? Do you read the ARK thing that came out last week? It was the most outlandish piece of, I don't want to call it research. it was about automated driving, and I looked at the number and I said, I'm not sure where this number is coming from, but you're making an options argument, which is, you know, if you buy Tesla at 160, you're getting a great car company and you're getting this optionality to be this leader in the automated driving business. People throw out options arguments all the time, and by forcing them to then confront the specifics of their own argument, you can talk about when the arguments make sense and when they don't. Any other questions? Yes. I don't care, right? Because all I have is intrinsic value. The price is whatever it is, right? So what I control is the value, right? If, as long as the price is less than the value, I'm getting a bargain. My value doesn't include any of this, so I'm going to add the option value. I have no idea what's in the price, to be quite honest. Doesn't matter, right? In a sense, if, let's say it does reflect options, you know how it's going to show up? The price is going to be $250 per share. I'm going to say, look, I'm not going to buy Facebook, and I'm going to move on. If it overestimates the value of the options. So we have no idea what the price includes or doesn't. It's not like investors come in and say, I'm buying this stock for the option at. You buy or sell. So all you observe in the price is a number. That's why you try to build the value up from scratch on the other hand to see if in fact you can get above the price. You might not. Maybe the price is being set so high because of the optionality, you can't even get to that point. You could argue that maybe with AI, that's already happening with some companies. Price is getting pushed up so much on pure oxygen of this big market that you can't get there with an intrinsic valuation plus an options argument. So you got option to delay, option to expand. Let's take the third option, the option to abandon. It's the only real option that's a put option. It gives you the right to walk away from an investment you've already made. And here's how it plays out. You have an investment. I give you the option to walk away. If you walk away, you get, let's say, half of what you invest. So you're going, you're going to lose money. But essentially, I cap your losses. So basically, I put a limit on your downside. So let's see how this plays out. So let's say your Airbus and Lear aircraft. And Lear Aircraft, I really, really want to be in a joint venture with you, because Lear Aircraft traditionally has produced corporate jets. Airbus, of course, has commercial jets. And Lear says, look, we want to produce commercial jets as well, but we can't do it on our own. So I approach you with a joint venture proposal. So you're going to have 50%. I'm going to have 50%. And you estimate your expected cash flows, decide whether to do this. You expect to, so you take the So the 50% that I offer you, I want $500 million for, and you calculate the cash flows and you come up with a present value of cash flows of $480 million. You say, no, we're not interested. Why? Because you're asking me for $500 million, it's worth only $480 million. So I offer you an add-on. I said, look, I know the net present value is minus $20 million, but if you invest and you change your mind anytime over the next 5 years, we will buy your 50% share back from you for $400 million. $100 million less than what you've invested. But basically, I'm saying you cannot lose more than $100 million. The option to buy it. So let's see whether this might tilt the scale. Because without it, it's a minus $20 million net present value. So the question is the option to abandon worth more than $20 million? Because if it is, I can take this investment that looks bad and make it into a good investment. So let's say you've done a simulation of the cash flows, because here, unlike oil prices, you can't observe the standard deviation, come up with a variance of 0.16. And let's say the project has a life of 30 years. That's going to come into play. So you have the right anytime over the next 5 years to walk away from the joint venture. So let's value the put. The present value of the cash flows is $480 million. The strike price is $400 million. But remember, this is a put. It's an out-of-the-money option, because you won't exercise today. Why walk away with $400 million? But anytime over the next 5 years, if the present value drops below $400 million, you will, of course, exercise your right to abandon. You see why I have to give you this right only for the next 5 years and not for the next 30 years? If I gave you this right for the next 30 years, you know exactly what you're going to do. You're going to wait for 29 years and 364 days. And the day before the project is supposed to be wound up. He said, you know what? I changed my mind. Give me 400 million. At which point the project is really worth nothing. So that's why I stopped after 5 years. Incidentally, this is a finite life project. So each year that you wait, remember the net present, the present value is going to get less, 29 years, 28 years. And here, because I know what the cash flows are, I compute that 1/30th each year that I wait that the cost. So that becomes the dividend yield. And here it's going to push up the value of the option. I plug the numbers in. I come up with the value for the put option of 73.23 million. Getting the right to be able to walk away anytime over the next 5 years on this project is worth 73 million. What is the NPV? Minus 20 million. By giving you this option to walk away, I've made it more likely, I can't guarantee it, that you will become a joint venture partner. This is a win, right? But here's the one thing I have to remember. I essentially gave you an option worth 73 million. So what should my net present value from this project have to be for this to be a good decision to make? On my side of the joint venture, I better be making an NPV well above 73 million. Otherwise, I've given you an option which I didn't really afford, which I can't really afford. Options to abandon essentially allow people to walk away from mistakes. I mean, at well below what they originally invested, but it still limits your losses to whatever that amount is. So here are the implications for investing. First, having an option to abandon a project is always good. But you have to work at creating it. So you, in terms of when you put together long projects, here are some of the things you might consider. You know, having shorter term contracts, even though they might cost you more than longer term contracts. The rule you're always given is, if you have a 30-year project, try to lock in things for the next 30 years. There's a downside to doing that. Having shorter contracts give you the flexibility. Yes. Yeah. So I remember I'm giving you this option. So I don't want to give you something that's so incredibly valuable that I end up poverty stricken, right? What I give you comes out of my pocket. This is a zero sum game. So collectively, we're gaining nothing from this, but you're gaining at my expense. So left to your own devices, Airbus will want a 30-year option. But I can't afford to do that. If I did that, I'd wipe myself out. So this is not just about increasing the value of the option to abandon, because somebody has to pay for it here. In this case, that's okay. So in terms of implication, just means building in more flexibility into your projects, in terms of taking them over multiple stages rather than all at one stage. Having contracts that expire in 3 years rather than in 30 years can add value to a project because it gives you some optionality. Final piece for today, let's talk a little bit about flexibility in general. I mean, if you think about, you know, about this has become a big buzzword at companies. We want to be flexible, we want to be adaptable. I think what we're talking about here is optionality. To me, the ultimate flexible company. Here's what happens. When you have something good happen on a project, you take advantage of it to make it even better. When you have something bad happen, you walk away sooner than everybody else. That used to be the old Goldman Sachs reputation, right? Which is they all, well, it might be because a Goldman Sachs guy was always at the top of the treasury, but it might also have been that they had the capacity to walk away from mistakes a little sooner than everybody else. That's an options argument for flexibility. And you could argue that companies that have more flexibility, when you do a DCF model, should have that premium built into them. Because even though you have expected cash flows, they're going to find a way to augment the good things that happen and kind of protect themselves against the bad things. So let's talk about one specific aspect of flexibility, which is financial flexibility. Now, some of you are in my corporate finance class as well, we talk about the optimal debt ratio for a company. Optimal debt ratio is 40%. But we also see that many companies choose to stay below their optimal. It's not that they don't know that they're underlevered, but they choose to be underlevered. And one of the arguments they use for not using that excess debt capacity is an options argument. And here's how the options argument goes. We know we're underlevered by 30%. We know we have a higher cost of capital than we should, but that's okay. Because that excess debt capacity is going to come into play in case we get a once in a lifetime project coming at us. 2 years from now, 4 years. We don't see it yet, but could come at any time. That's the key here, is something unexpected shows up. So think of what, when a company sets aside, you know, decides how much to borrow and how much to reinvest, it has an expected reinvestment. Each year we expect to invest 100 million. So let's make that the strike price. But if you get this incredible project that shows up, your reinvestment needs are going to be far larger than what you get in a typical year. So typically you invest 100 million a year, but that project shows up, you need 1 billion. If you have excess debt capacity, here's what you hope to do. You hope to take that excess debt capacity and take that once in a lifetime project. So you're preserving excess debt capacity to be able to take that insanely great. And if you do, you get the net present value of that project, that becomes the upside. Is it possible that that great project might never show up? Yeah, in which case, what have you lost? By being underlevered, you had a much higher cost to capital than you did, and that becomes the cost. So actually, you know what, you can actually try to value this flexibility, but more interesting than putting a value in the flexibility is actually thinking about the implications. So this is actually from one of my earlier editions of Applied Corporate Finance. I computed an optimal debt ratio for Disney to be 40%, cost of capital of 11.64%. They were actually at 18%. And in a sense, you could see Disney knew they were underlevered. And the argument they were making, we need the excess debt capacity. We'll come back and examine it. But one of the things I tried to do was estimate how much that excess debt capacity was creating as value as an option. Right now, what are they paying for the option? Their cost of capital is 12.22%. It could be 11%. They're paying 0.58% each year because they want to preserve flexibility. This option value is kind of murky, so kind of hang in there. To value this option, I need to first figure out, you know, what they create as cash flows each year. So that becomes the S in the model. The K in the model becomes how much you can raise as capital from within. So right now, what they require as reinvestment is about 5.3% of value. What they can come up with as cash flows is 4.8%. But there's uncertainty about that reinvestment. Coming from where? They might have to do a big acquisition, a huge investment. So if you think of this as the option, the right to be able to take an investment that's much larger than your typical investment, the value that you get for the flexibility is about 0.85% a year. Comes out, it looks like it's magical, but basically it says, look, because you're uncertain about your future reinvestment needs, that flexibility is worth 0.85% a year. What are they paying each year for it? 0.58% a year. If the numbers are hold up, it basically means that when Disney says, we're not going to the optimal, we're going to accept a higher cost of capital, you step back and say, okay, you have a good reason for doing so. That's okay. So next session when we start, I want to look at this value flexibility, at least in terms of implication, because I'm very interesting, you know, implications for what kinds of companies should be underlevered. And actually, it's the right thing for them to do. And what kinds of companies should be forced towards their optimal?
Thank you.